China, one of the world's oldest civilizations, was a great power in the past, and is determined to become the global superpower in the coming decades.
When British historian Niall Ferguson was asked if he believes that China will be the superpower of the 21st century, he said, "Of course it will, because China was the superpower in every century, except the 19th.
Everything that happened in that century is still engraved in China's collective memory. Those events are essential to understanding today's China." For thousands of years, up until the end of the 18th century, the emperors of all Chinese dynasties considered their domains the center of the world. In fact, the Mandarin term that's been in use for centuries and became China's official name in 1912 is Shangguo, meaning Middle Kingdom or Central State.
China considered itself the center of the world, with everything around it as periphery, and anything beyond that was simply the barbarian world. There was no real interest in understanding, seeing, or above all, conquering what lay beyond, because there was nothing civilized to discover or obtain there.
Now, until the 18th century, China had always been limited by natural boundaries. To the west is the Pacific Ocean, to the north, the Gobi Desert, to the southwest, the Himalayan Mountains, and dense tropical forests to the south, the central Indochina dry forests. For millennia, advancing beyond these natural boundaries was too costly and too difficult. But in the last years of the 18th century, everything changed. In 1793, the court of Qianlong, emperor of the Qing dynasty, received a group of white foreigners. They were led by George Macartney, the first British ambassador to China. He was traveling at the behest of the British East India Company to get the Chinese Empire to ease restrictions on trade with the West and to open several ports to further British commercial interests. After overcoming China's reluctance and gaining permission to dock in Canton, modern-day Guangzhou, Macartney arrived before Emperor Qianlong, merely bowing to him instead of performing the kowtow, kneeling and placing his forehead on the floor as required by protocol. Nevertheless, the meeting was cordial, leaving the British ambassador convinced that his requests would be granted. But Macartney was wrong. This paragraph of the edict sent to King George III made things very clear. If your ships land, your merchants will never be allowed to disembark or settle. They will be expelled immediately. In that case, your merchants will have made a long journey for nothing. Do not claim that you were not warned. Obey the instructions with due respect and without neglect. But the British didn't take no for an answer. They were buying massive quantities of Chinese silk, tea, and porcelain, and paying for it in silver, since the Chinese weren't interested in trading for British products. That meant China was amassing huge amounts of silver, while the British were unable to place their goods. But then they found the perfect product to solve the trade deficit: opium. China's upper classes imported opium from India, consuming it in private because it was forbidden in China. But the British managed to smuggle it into China and flood the market. As more people got addicted, demand went up. Soon, opium's debilitating effects were seen on the population in cities and villages across China. The opium epidemic threatened the empire's economy and the health of its subjects. The emperor stiffened penalties for opium trafficking. His agents confiscated and destroyed 1,400 tons of drugs stored in Canton by British traders. In response, British warships attacked Qianlong's troops, who were unable to defend the port city. That's how the British Empire's occupation of Canton began.
It's striking that in order to make money and engage in trade, Britain was willing to go to war and force China to accept the opium trade, a drug that is extraordinarily addictive and extremely difficult to quit.
To end the First Opium War, the British made China sign the Treaty of Nanjing in 1842 aboard the British warship HMS Cornwallis. The agreement forced China to give Hong Kong to the British and to open four more ports to foreign trade, because until then, European merchants could only buy and sell goods in the city of Canton.
What is truly scandalous here is that in order to achieve a positive balance of payments for Britain, London forced China, through war, to accept the opium trade. It's as if a drug cartel today were to force a state to legalize drug trafficking, with the cartel being the main supplier of the drugs. As if that weren't scandalous enough, opium served for Britain largely as a battering ram to break down the limitations and restrictions on trade that had been imposed by the Chinese Empire.
China's defeat in the First Opium War shocked the nation. The country that considered itself the center of the world and the most civilized society on the planet had been humiliated by barbarians from far away. And it wasn't just the British. The defeat opened the door to further exploitation by other foreign powers. In 1844 and 1845, China also allowed Christians from France and the United States to carry out missionary work in its territory and agreed that foreign nationals would be subject to the laws of their own countries and not to Chinese law. But in the mid-19th century, foreign powers were seeking even greater access to a market that then numbered 400 million people. Tensions arising from the increasing Western demands and China's reluctance to comply with them led to the Second Opium War, fought between 1856 and 1860, with France joining the British. British soldiers even captured Beijing, or Peking as they called it, and burned the Summer Palace, the emperor's official residence. After that, a new peace treaty forced China to legalize opium, in addition to opening 10 new Chinese ports to foreign trade. It also obligated the country to pay war reparations. While fighting the British and the French, in 1858, China was also forced to sign the Treaty of Agun with Russia, making extensive territorial concessions to the Tsars. All territory on the left bank of the Amur River and lands east of the Ussuri River. It also granted Russia special trade rights in Manchuria in northern China.
During this century, the European powers competed to acquire territories and markets all over the world. And they also had technological and military superiority over the rest of the world's cultures. This coincided with a time when the Chinese Empire was suffering from major internal problems. With a population of 400 million, the Chinese Empire was finding it increasingly difficult to find farmland to feed its own people. What was the consequence? Misery continued to grow and poverty kept increasing. This led to increasingly significant revolts, armed uprisings, and small civil wars that only further weakened the country. Of course, if you have a pack of wolves circling around and a little lamb growing weaker, the consequences are easy to predict.
Although the Qing dynasty had set out to modernize its army to better defend itself against foreign powers, poverty, state corruption, and inefficiency put an end to attempts at reform. The court, headed by Empress Regent Cixi, considered industrialization and modernization, including modernizing the army, to be unnecessary expenditures.
At the end of the 19th century, the Empress Dowager Cixi, who was the regent of the country, decided to rebuild the Summer Palace in Beijing, which had been the residence of the Chinese emperors. The palace had been destroyed during the Second Opium War. What she did to fund the reconstruction was divert a large amount of money from the budget allocated to the modernization of the Chinese navy. In fact, this sparked a lot of criticism. The palace is located by the shore of a lake, and on the lake, there is a life-sized marble boat, often seen as an ironic response to this criticism. It's as if to say, yes, we used the Navy's money, but look, we built a boat.
But while China refused to modernize, Japan was studying and incorporating into its culture advancements in Western science, politics, and technology in what it called the Meiji Restoration. Within a few decades, the Empire of Japan grew into a regional power in search of more raw materials. Its plan was to take them, starting in Korea, then moving into Manchuria. In August of 1894, Japan declared war on China. After 6 months of successive defeats against the Japanese army, Beijing petitioned for peace and paid a high price for it.
Japan got to keep Taiwan and the Pescadores Islands, now known as the Penghu Islands.
China also lost its control over Korea. For China, losing Korea as a vassal state was yet another wound inflicted by a country it considered inferior. That defeat added to the other humiliations at the hands of foreign powers, resulting in protests and revolts in China against everything related to foreignness and modernity. Most notably, the Boxer Rebellion. The Boxers were a secret society characterized by their practice of martial arts, their religiosity, and their xenophobia. In 1900, the Boxers launched an uprising supported by the court against what they called foreign devils. They slaughtered Chinese Christians, destroyed telegraph poles, and besieged foreign diplomats in Beijing. An expeditionary army consisting of British, Russian, French, German, Japanese, Italian, and Austro-Hungarian units rescued the diplomatic delegations and defeated the Boxers. But another nationalist movement was forming, one that wanted not to make China more traditional or remove foreign influence, but instead to modernize it. Led by physician and politician Sun Yat-sen, who dreamed of establishing a Western-style republic in China.
Within Chinese society by the late 19th century, and especially at the beginning of the 20th century, there was an increasing number of intellectuals and politicians, or rather, more people with an academic background, who began to realize there was a need to look outward.
Sun Yat-sen aimed to learn from other countries, but his goal was to free China from subjugation to foreign powers. He also wanted to improve the living conditions of China's peasants. In 1911, his uprising quickly spread through China, leading to the fall of the Qing dynasty and thousands of years of Chinese imperial rule. In the new Republic of China, Sun Yat-sen's Chinese Nationalist Party, or Kuomintang, was set to play a key role. As the party's founder, Sun Yat-sen was appointed as the first president of the republic, but he ceded power to a figure of the old regime, the powerful General Yuan Shikai, commander of the Northern Army. Yuan Shikai forced the abdication of Puyi, the last Chinese emperor. At the time, in 1912, Emperor Puyi was only 6 years old. Although China then became a constitutional republic with a parliament, in practice, it was a dictatorship ruled by Yuan Shikai. In 1915, he even tried in vain to restore the empire with himself on the throne. After he died the next year, China entered a period ruled by various warlords. The military commanders of the provinces started to act as autonomous states. Tibet and Mongolia, conquered 2 centuries earlier, took advantage of this chaos to become independent. All of this fed into the discontent that had taken root in Chinese society since the mid-19th century. In the early 20th century, many people in China looked to the Russian Revolution of 1917 as an example to follow. In 1921, groups disenchanted with Sun Yat-sen's Kuomintang founded the Communist Party of China. Its ideals were not totally foreign to Chinese society.
Regarding this age, which is also very important for the current age, we must mention Confucianism, not just Confucianism as a philosophy. It can be considered a school of statecraft. It's based on harmony. And above all, it's based on the idea that everyone fulfills his or her role. The system of Confucianism emphasizes more than moral leadership and has guided governance in China. There have been certain interruptions, but it has always been present for more than 2,000 years. It's based on a fusion of public and private. The people, the subjects of the emperor, do not really have a private life, but they have a public function, and this public function is to obey their superior.
Contrary to most Western philosophies, it holds that social harmony is above all else and that, in fact, the individual achieves fulfillment through their social function. What's interesting is that all this aligns quite well with communism and Marxism, which both emphasize society over the individual, where the individual is subordinated.
Parts of Chinese society saw communism almost as a way out of the chaos generated by the warlord period of the early 20th century. At the beginning, following Moscow's recommendation, the Chinese Communist Party maintained an alliance with the Kuomintang, even though it was a bourgeois party, to form a united front against foreign powers. After Sun Yat-sen's death in 1925, his position at the head of the Kuomintang was taken over by Chiang Kai-shek. In 1926, Chiang Kai-shek launched an offensive against rival military chiefs to become the president of the republic. Although the Kuomintang and the Communist Party had cooperated against the warlords, Chiang Kai-shek distrusted the communists from the beginning. In 1927, he orchestrated a massacre against them in Shanghai, killing 5,000 people. That sparked the civil war between the Communist Party of China and the Kuomintang. Despite Japan's increasing aggression, Chiang Kai-shek still believed that his main enemy was the Chinese Communist Party. At that time, a young man named Mao Zedong was beginning to take leadership of the Communist Party, which still only had a presence in rural areas. Under pressure by Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists, Mao's communists withdrew their troops to the mountains between Jiangxi and Fujian. There, he founded the Jiangxi Soviet, the beginnings of the future People's Republic of China. Meanwhile, Kuomintang troops conquered the communist-controlled regions surrounding Jiangxi. Aware of the danger, in 1934, Mao ordered what would later be known as the Long March. 86,000 communists began a year-long retreat over 12,000 kilometers, to reach the remote northern province of Shanxi. Of those 86,000, fewer than 10,000 survived. In 1931, the Japanese Empire returned to China.
It occupied Manchuria and established there the puppet state of Manchukuo,
installing Puyi, the last emperor of China, as its figurehead monarch. Emboldened by the lack of international reaction, Japan also occupied the neighboring province of Hebei in 1933. Japan's aim was to turn all of China into a Japanese vassal state. Even so, the Chinese communists and nationalists didn't stop fighting each other until 1936, when they finally became aware of the threat posed by Japan. By then, it was too late. Tokyo declared war on China and set out to conquer the whole country. In a few months, despite heavy casualties, Japan captured a large part of eastern China, including Beijing and Shanghai. At the end of 1937, Japan launched a brutal assault on the civilian population of Nanjing, the capital of nationalist China, aiming to break the Chinese resistance. It's estimated they killed around 300,000 people in the Nanjing massacre. Some accounts say it was 500,000.
Nanking was filled with small groups of Japanese soldiers who engaged in looting, setting fires, murdering and torturing the civilian population. They killed them with gunshots, bayonets and rifle butts, simply because perhaps they didn't remove their hats when they saw a soldier. There were also instances of extreme cruelty, such as mass shootings, mass beheadings and even burying people alive. They often left their heads exposed, using them as targets for Japanese soldiers' gunfire, for bayonet stabs, or even tanks running over them.
Survivors described watching in terror as the Japanese soldiers shot their fathers, threw their baby siblings to the ground, gang-raped and mutilated their mothers and sisters.
On the morning of December 13, 1937, a squad of Japanese soldiers, about 30 men, came to the door of our house and knocked. As soon as he opened the door, they shot the landlord. My father, upon seeing him, knelt before the Japanese soldiers and begged them not to kill the other people. But they also used their guns to kill him. My mother, frightened, picked up my one-year-old sister and crawled under a table. The Japanese soldiers pulled her out, snatched my little sister from her hands, and killed her by throwing her on the floor. Then they took off all my mother's clothes, and several Japanese soldiers gang-raped her, killed her with a bayonet, and stuck a bottle in her genitals. Then several Japanese soldiers burst into the next room where my grandfather, grandmother, and my two older sisters were. The Japanese soldiers wanted to rape my sisters. My grandmother desperately protected them, but she was brutally killed. The Japanese tore off my two sisters' clothes. They were gang-raped and then killed by the same Japanese soldiers with their bayonets. Then the soldiers inserted a large stick into my older sister's genitals. I was hiding under the quilt of the bed and screamed in terror. The Japanese soldiers stabbed me 3 times in the back with their bayonets. I fainted and became unconscious.
2 Japanese officers bet on who could kill more enemies with their katana. This contest was advertised in the Japanese press. Initially, it was about seeing who of the two could be the first to decapitate 100 people. But when they couldn't determine who reached 100 first, they decided to continue the contest and bet on who could decapitate the most people.
After the war, evidence of that contest reached the International Military Tribunal for the Far East that was established by the Allies. Those 2 Japanese officers were extradited to China and sentenced to death by the Nanjing War Crimes Tribunal. In 1941, after Japan bombed the U.S. base at Pearl Harbor, Japan's war against China became part of the broader conflict of World War II, forcing Tokyo to divert resources to other fronts. The USSR declared war against Japan in 1945 and launched a massive invasion of Japanese-controlled Manchuria. That, combined with the U.S. dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, forced Japan's surrender.
Mao Zedong is head of the Communist Party, which dominates North China provinces with a population of some 90 million.
In China, the Communist Party emerged from the war much stronger than the Kuomintang. It had created an army, and by advocating for land reform, had won the support of the peasants. At the same time, the Kuomintang was increasingly facing rejection for corruption and for its association with large landowners. The communists also received huge stockpiles of Japanese weapons from the Soviets, who had captured them in Manchuria. In 1948, the communists launched a general offensive, and in just a few months, conquered almost the entire country. On October 1st, 1949, Mao Zedong proclaimed the founding of the People's Republic of China in Tiananmen Square. The remnants of the Kuomintang army, under pressure from the communists, fled to Taiwan, where they established a rival government.